This is Solidarity Wyoming. Jeff Lockwood is a UW professor of natural sciences and humanities. He's a scholar on everything from biology and agriculture to philosophy and creative writing. A couple of years ago, Jeff stuck his neck out pretty far when he published Behind the Carbon Curtain, an account of how Wyoming's politicians, university trustees, and administrators have censored both art and science about climate change and the fossil fuel industry in a misguided and often unethical effort to stifle criticism of the industry. 2 years later, political and economic change is accelerating in Wyoming and all over the world. The climate news also gets more and more intense. And I recently spoke to Jeff, not just about the book, but about a viable and sustainable vision of a post-fossil fuel Wyoming. It might turn out to be a pretty beautiful place.
Is there an unusual conversation or a memorable conversation that you had with someone while writing the book or after publishing the book? A phone call, not necessarily somebody, you know, threatening to cajole you or something like that, but, you know, did you have any interesting or weird conversations with people that stand out?
I did. And I guess the one that really comes to mind is the case study over in Carbon County and with the county commissioners there. And I kind of had in my mind that this was going to be simple, straightforward, black and white, right? That the politicians were more black hats, right? And the environmental concern people were white hats. And I went over there with a kind of simplistic notion of good and evil and came back much more confused or maybe empathetic toward those politicians. Wyoming politicians are not particularly savvy, right? They're not particularly experienced. They're not particularly worldly. And so they can be manipulated, duped, scared by people from industry with big money, big experience, and lots of power. And so while I thought the commissioners had just buckled in a cowardly way, I realized that they were genuinely frightened for their constituents, and that they were, decent, hardworking, well-meaning people who I think got it tragically wrong, but not because of any sort of moral shortcomings, but because I think they were just completely outmatched by industry and by clever lawyers.
I'm thinking also about the conspiracy to buy up the LA trolley cars in the 1930s. And you've heard about how, you know, these people in the auto and oil and even rubber industry were like, let's buy all the trolley cars and then shut them down so that we can force, you know, this highway system. And I thought about what a strange world we live in where that's a thing, right? And it's almost like people will do these really Rube Goldberg kind of things to keep a certain type of economy going.
Well, is it really that different in a weird way, right? I mean, that involves material purchase of objects that we're going to compete with.
But you're literally manipulating the outside world to reach this particular outcome. And you're doing, it reminds me of the kids who will do, you know, when your kids will do more work to avoid work.
Right. Yeah. Or the student who spends more time coming up with a clever way of hiding his notes on the test.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Than just studying. Yeah. Do you feel like that's, I mean, how much of that is part of this whole experience of studying the political economy of Wyoming's fossil fuel dependency?
No, that's a wonderful analogy. And I think we see that, right? I think we see that with the efforts. I mean, we're seeing in the efforts to come up with these convoluted ways of keeping individuals from producing their own power and then putting it back onto the grid when it's generated in excess. And of course, if the notion was, you know, if power is sort of like transportation, right, which is let's serve society, Why would you buy up all the streetcars in Los Angeles? And why would you construct all of these Byzantine rules to prevent individual homeowners from producing and loading their power onto the grid? And it has that same feel of ridiculousness. And supporting or propping up. See, in Los Angeles, I think they were, to a large extent, propping up. The difference would be they were propping up an industry that they saw was coming.
Was coming up.
And here we see the same sort of bizarre Rube Goldberg-esque legal manipulations to keep something down. But there is the parallel.
That's fascinating because it means that people, you know, otherwise really intelligent people are going to spend a lot of mental energy, doing something just to keep things the way they are. And you probably talked to a lot of people where you were thinking, these are really intelligent people. Wouldn't it be nice if we were all involved in a common effort to move forward?
When I was in the College of Agriculture years ago, I worked with a number of people in the chemical industry, particularly the pesticide industry. And there was also very smart people and some very well-meaning people. But I also came to realize that in that world, that corporate world, which is really not all that different than the corporate world of energy, a tremendous amount of energy is put into manipulating the system, a system of laws, rules, and policies to suppress the competition. Right. Instead of just beating them in the marketplace, right, what you do is you try to create regulations and obstacles so that you can beat them in the policy arena so you don't have to go head to head with them in the marketplace. We certainly see that with energy today. Let's really level the playing field. And what we're finding is that the renewables on a reasonably level playing field are smoking fossil fuels right now.
The university in your book is both victim and perpetrator, would you say that it would be too easy to see this as the trustees versus the university in terms of those poles of perpetrator and victim? Is it not that simple, or in some ways is it that simple? How is the university implicated?
I think it's more complex than that. Although, if I had to distill it. It comes down to a bunch of appointed politicians versus a bunch of perhaps idealistic academics. And I think the missing part of that is the administration, to be sympathetic to some extent, they're squeezed in the middle. They're squeezed by the faculty who may have a deep sense of what's right, and they are squeezed by the trustees who have a deep sense of what's expedient. And trying to sustain at least a modicum of what's right in the face of what's expedient is the place that the administration finds itself. I don't have much sympathy because they're well paid and they know the deal. And if they don't have the integrity to do the job, they shouldn't have taken it. But that is the push-pull. And faculty sort of have a luxury, perhaps, of thinking in more straightforward moral terms. The trustees, I guess, have the luxury of thinking in amoral financial terms. The administration is in the between place.
When the political rhetoric and the actual material practices of powerful industry in the state is, we will shut the university down if you continue on this path. When you see manifestations of that, how much of you is like, let's call their bluff? And what would happen? I mean, let's hypothesize what would happen if you did have an administration that was committed to academic inquiry and also to science and all of those things. And what would happen if that bluff were called?
Gosh, you know, that's a great question. So one thing that could happen is the university would shrink in terms of its size, but I'm not sure that that's a disaster. It would not perhaps have the legislative support that it has up till now, which means that it would have to find funding. You know, basically the university gets funding from three places, right? It's tuition, grants, and contracts, or private funding, we'll just call it that, and public funding. Over the long haul, we might have a much smaller university with greater integrity and perhaps a richer diversity and a greater balance of programs. This move to become a STEM institution, I think, is completely silly and wrongheaded. And I think all the sort of cultural, social, economic evidence would suggest that's a dead end. And the other possibility, I mean, I've talked about this, this is the heretical possibility, right? And that is the legislature would figure out one of two things. We'll just outsource higher education. We don't need a University of Wyoming. It's consuming 22% of our budget. We could do it for a fraction of that to send our students into adjacent states. So that would be a possibility. The other one is to convert the University of Wyoming into basically a technical school. That would be the other direction is, where the legislature would decide that what we really need is Wyoming Tech. And in some ways, I think we're headed that way.
I was going to say,
almost anyway.
We didn't, the administration didn't call their bluff. And some of these consequences that you're talking about are inevitable.
Kind of take this sideways.
Yeah.
Talk about being radical, right? I think universal basic income in some form is on the horizon. I think that's where we're headed. I think the 40-hour work week is going to die for various reasons. But if you look at all the sociological economic prognosticators, that looks to be the case. People will work fewer hours. So where would the University of Wyoming, right, position itself for that coming future? Well, what it means is that people will have to start finding meaning in their lives through something other than labor,
mm-hmm.
right? So your purpose in life will not be reduced to the salary or wages you earn for your work. So how will we find meaning? Well, I think we'll find meaning through natural history, through natural sciences, through the arts and humanities, right? And so what if the University of Wyoming saw that coming? I think we have the raw potential to become the leading state university in the Rocky Mountain region for the fields of the natural sciences, arts, and humanities, to address how a workforce mm-hmm. will find meaning in a world where work is not the sole definition of the person's worth.
What an interesting vision to combine with the notion that these communities in Wyoming are going to be changing so much, and what what that might mean, like a nurturing and sort of healthy approach would include changes in the orientation of the university, as well as that sort of accompany the changes in the economy of these communities. That sounds like a synergistic kind of way to think about the changes in the state. And it's a vision that a lot of us are very invested in. And obviously, we feel like we're Sisyphus,
No, absolutely. And with the inevitable coming collapse of the fossil fuel industry and what that's going to mean to the state in terms of our revenues, I think what we need to be doing is talking about how are we going to have a vibrant, healthy life in Wyoming with 300,000 people, because that might well be the sustainable population given our location, given our limitations, given our resources. And I also think that what we need to be doing right now is, weirdly, right, is going and deeply looking at the Rust Belt. What happens when a company town has its industry disappear? So look at Pittsburgh and the renaissance of Pittsburgh. Look at Detroit, how it's beginning to come back. But then look at some of the rural communities that aren't coming back, right, with the opioid crisis. That's our future. The Rust Belt is our future. You can do it well with a renaissance, or you can do it poorly and slide into a downward spiral. I think that's what we're going to be facing. And I don't think we've thought through what went right and what went wrong in those model communities.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple of things I wanted to invite you to briefly retell.
Yeah.
One is how the carbon sink fiasco was not just a crackdown on one artist or one work, but was a crackdown on in some ways, on the entire art community and individual galleries, around the state that might deign to, have critical work and stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think you've nailed it, right? So one of the things that struck me early on about the carbon sink fiasco was, why would you invest so much energy, right, as an industry in crushing one piece of art, right? But that's not what it was about. It was about sending a message to the art community at large, all right? It was a warning shot. This could happen to you. And so it did happen at the Nicolaysen Museum, all right? So at the Nicolaysen Museum, there was supposed to be a photo exhibit that was going to show sort of a before and after, or a contrast between lands that had been impacted by coal bed methane extraction and those that were still intact. And that was a photographic documentary sort of journalistic exhibit, and it was absolutely quashed, shut down. And that arguably sort of lays the foundation for empowering the fossil fuel industry for then shutting down Carbon Sink. And now we start looking around at public art, right? And I know a number of people in public art, and there's some, you know, beautiful and industry things happening out there, but I don't think that they're politically powerful and economically provocative, because I think they've gotten the message. And so will that, I think that will affect artwork for a generation. And that's a pretty scary thing, because, you know, as I told people about Carbon Sink, the upside of that whole thing was to demonstrate sort of empirically the incredible power of art. Mm-hmm. Right. There had been number of papers published at the university on climate change. None of them had generated this outrage on the part of the legislature. It's art, right, that cut to the soul of the energy industry and that collaboration. And so, you know, I think artists are now, have been warned. Museums, including the Nicolaysen, as well as the UW Art Museum, have been warned. And I think there's a, and this is the scariest part for me of censorship, is the self-censorship. It's not the destruction of the piece that's already been made. That's horrible. But it's the 100 other pieces that are imagined but never realized because the artist says, do I want to get into that? Mm-hmm. And it's that, that's really the insidious part of what happened with the blatant acts of censorship, is what follows in terms of self-censorship.
And the other thing is the story of Jeffrey Thine. Jeffrey.
Yes.
Yeah, not Joffrey.
No, Jeffrey. Yeah, Jeffrey,
yeah.
Thine.
Jeffrey Thine. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what happened to Jeffrey Thine.
Yeah. So Jeffrey Thine was a scientist who grew up actually in Florida, and was not a sterling student early in his life, but really did catch on and find a passion for science via, interestingly enough, public education, public institutions, public universities. And so he ended up with this sense of real duty and obligation to return to the public, given what the public had provided to him. All right. So that kind of is lurking in his soul, right, is that there's a duty, a responsibility. And so he goes into energy development, and in particular, groundwater. And he's down at the Colorado School of Mines, and his expertise is called upon with regard to evaluating fracking. And he looks into this and comes to the conclusion, the radical conclusion, that, well, from what he could tell, fracking can actually be done well. But a certain percentage, a small percentage of wells will be done badly. The casing will crack. And it doesn't take but a very small percentage to create a horrific consequence in terms of groundwater contamination. That's sort of his conclusion. And he thought that he would sort of be welcomed by the industry. He said, well, let's look at the few bad apples. Let's find the ones that are a problem. Let's fix or shut those down, and we'll save the industry and the society mm-hmm. these tremendous costs. And of course, what was seen by industry was, well, this is the environmental camel's nose under the tent. We can't admit, right, that anything could possibly go wrong. So he's summarily dismissed, comes to the University of Wyoming, begins to work for the School of Energy as a scientist there, part of the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute. He is asked by a reporter, who, and this is when Wyoming was looking at fracking in the southeastern corner of the state. And reporter asked him, well, what would be the amount of water that we would expect these fracking operations to require. And so he uses the best science that he has available, looks at the published literature, comes up with an estimate, all right? And a range of estimates. And of course, the journalist publishes, you know, the high end, right? Mm-hmm. This looks like it could consume...
As much as, right?
Yeah. And that goes out in the press, and the energy industry goes ballistic. And now he's not associated with that estimates, but they go after the Cheyenne Tribune Eagle to divulge their source and put the screws apparently to the editor, and the editor coughs up Jeffrey Thine's name. That's who gave us that number. Well, he gets called into the vice president's office for an interrogation, and basically says, did you do this? And he said, I was asked a question. I have an obligation. I'm a public employee. I have a responsibility to use my expertise and knowledge for the public good. And they said, you will retract. His supervisor said, you will retract that estimate.
Who said that? Who told him to do that?
It was his direct supervisor.
Do you remember the name?
And I'd have to pull that up. But that was the order that came down. You will go on the record as saying you were mistaken. And he said, well, look, he said, I'm a scientist. I'm used to being mistaken. Scientists are always making mistakes. He said, you give me the data that shows I'm wrong, and I will race to the retraction. And they said, we won't do that. You will retract it, right? And so he said, no, I won't, right? And he wrote this sort of half-assed letter, and then they edited it. They edited his own letter that went out to the press. And the press was not interested in these sort of nuanced corrections. Uh-huh. And then the irony of the whole story was that the best evidence that he had from published literature probably was an overestimation of the amount of water. And the industry had in their coffers better numbers, but they were trade secrets, so they would not divulge them. And so rather than telling the truth, right, they maintained their right to secrecy. And that, I mean, to me, so I tell students, I mean, it's just, you know, that there was a time in this country, right, before there was an EPA when you could apply insecticides and you didn't have to tell the public what was in your airplane. And they just sort of roll their eyes. How could you possibly? There couldn't have been a time like that, right? And they just can't imagine it. But then I tell them, well, yeah, but now we live in a time in which you can pump chemicals into the water table and you don't have to divulge their chemistry. You've touched on the deep irony, right, of the conservatives' notion of free market, right? And it's, what they don't include in that is, of course, the enormous infrastructure that's already been put in place that the fossil fuel industry hasn't had to pay for, right? And so even setting that aside, all of these efforts, I was talking to a person who knows energy economics, and I said, well, what would happen, right, if there was clean coal tomorrow? Right? We could burn coal with zero emissions. He said, it wouldn't matter. And he said, emissions are not what's shutting down coal. You know, globally, that's surely a concern, but what's killing coal is natural gas. Right. He said it's that market as well as the rise of the renewables that's killing coal. And of course, the irony there, right, the profound irony in the rise of natural gas is that we're extracting that at low cost in large part because of a non-regulated fracking industry that doesn't have to conform to Clean Air, Clean Water Act. Right. Mm-hmm. And so here we've got the coal industry. Right. As fracking was on its upswing, if they had insisted that the natural gas, fossil fuel, fracking industry had to conform to the same environmental regulations that they had to, they might have been able to eke out a significantly longer period of economic viability. But fracking got a free ride, right? And so in a sense, the coal industry's, you know, hatred of regulations, right, came back to bite them on the butt. And now they're getting smoked by natural gas at a rate that, you know, is far greater than I think it would have been had we had reasonable environmental regulations on that industry, which we don't. So here's an example, just a tiny, tiny, tiny example at the University of Wyoming. I've got a research associate, former research associate, who proposed to the university. They said, look, what do we do well? Right? And one of the things apparently that we do well is veteran services. right? Veterans apparently are treated pretty damn well. We seem to have an infrastructure at the university that works well with veterans. And so he said, well, what's the equivalent? Look down the line, right? He said, it's wildland firefighters, right? Short, hard careers, right? Out in the world, out in the natural world. And they're going to be looking for their next, at the age of 25, 26, 27, they're going to be looking what's next. Their body can't sustain that for very long. So he said, we should become the place where with outreach education and other programs, we become the go-to place for the growing number of wildland firefighters who are going to be looking for what comes next. Mm-hmm. And talk about a market that has growth potential. Mm-hmm. Wildland fires are not going to go away.
What gives you joy?
Well, I look around the world, I look at climate change, right? And God, on the horizon, that looks pretty horrible. And I look at Wyoming and I look at the nation. Oh my God, you look at Washington, you look at the presidency right now, and you think, wow, where am I going to, can I find any joy there? You look at the Wyoming legislature and its lack of imagination, courage, and integrity. Can I find any joy there? God, I don't think so. So, what I'm finding, and this might sound kind of bad in some ways, is I'm finding more and more joy as a function of the local, all right? There's joy in the farmer's market. There's joy in my fellowship. There's joy in my family. There's joy in this incredible possibility of acquiring the Pilot Hill land, right, for our community. And so at the local level and, of my religious community, my social community, I'm finding my joy there now. And I think there's a sense of, so I've said this about activism, right? You have to be, as an activist, you have to do it because of a sense of calling. It's who you are. You can't do otherwise. It's what you must do, right? And it's building your own sense of identity and character. If, as a consequence, the world gets better, right? We turn the corner with climate change, right? We turn the corner with the next election. Then my feeling is, yay, world. Good for you, world. But I can't stake my joy on the outcome of my trying to do what is right. It has to be done because that's what has to be done.
I think we're going to see more examples of the kind of authoritarian behavior that Jeff described in the book. The book is Behind the Carbon Curtain, and it's still a really good read. In fact, it's an even better read now, 2 years later, because, as we said, things have really accelerated. It's published by University of New Mexico Press. You can get it just about anywhere that you would normally get such a book. And we encourage you to try local booksellers and also not to use Amazon. Before I go on and talk about the recent Albany County for Proper Policing meeting and the drive by ACOP and other groups to promote community accountability boards to oversee policing, I want to urge you to support this show on patreon.com/solidarityhouse. If you like interviews like this with Jeff, and if you like news and updates about activism and the changing political landscape in Wyoming, then you definitely want to support this podcast. And you can do that for $5 a month at patreon.com/solidarityhouse. If you like our interviews with folks like Eric Mulvar, Sabrina King, Jeff Lockwood, Antonio Serrano, we need your support to keep the podcast and the project of Solidarity House Cooperative going here in Laramie, Wyoming. That's patreon.com/solidarityhouse. Please support us today. In fact, when you subscribe to our Patreon for $5 a month, you get bonus material, premium content. And this week, that premium content is an almost hour-long recording of my interview with Jeff Lockwood. It's Jeff and Matt, raw and uncut, as it were. And it's more discussion about Wyoming politics and the absurd behavior of corporations and university trustees and administrators. And Jeff reads an alternate ending for his book that was too provocative, apparently, for the general public. A couple of weeks ago, Albany County for Proper Policing hosted another public forum about police reform and the bad behavior and anti-democratic attitudes of the Albany County Sheriff's Office. I'm not a member of ACOP, but I attended the meeting ready to help. One of the most important revelations of the meeting was that there continue to be complaints against other officers in the Sheriff's Department. You know, Sheriff Dave O'Malley, he who hired killer cop Derek Colling without adequate deliberation about Colling's violent background and behavior, Sheriff O'Malley has, to his credit, started mental health crisis response training for his deputies. But this remedial effort feels really like the department is trying to play catch-up. In the meantime, Derek Colling, who still works for the Sheriff's Department, was fired from a crossover job that he'd had with the Laramie Police Department, the city police. Colling was part of a special response team there, but after he killed Robbie Ramirez, who was unarmed, the LPD suspended him, and finally, just recently, the LPD let the other shoe drop and fired him outright. ACOP reported that the reason for the firing was generally known to be Colling's unpredictability. You know, the liability the city would carry if Colling again became unhinged on the job and hurt somebody else. LPD didn't deny that this was the reason. At the ACOP meeting, we also heard a recorded narrative from Alexander Sutton, who had done a university internship with the county jail run by the Sheriff's Department. So Alexander Sutton talked about guards and cops there who were calling inmates racist names, about the mistreatment of people of color there. It was an eye-opening uncovering of yet another layer of incompetence and malevolence on the part of this sheriff's department and this county. Finally, ACOP at the meeting laid out the case for a civilian oversight and review board, something they had put on the table months ago as a proposed long-term policy change. Such a board would be independent of the police. It would have to be given adequate resources to investigate allegedly bad police behavior, and it would have to have some kind of mandate to serve the community and really authoritatively oversee the police, even if it didn't have the power to terminate officers directly. Now, community review boards would also probably have to be approved by the state legislature in Wyoming, but don't quote me on that. More legal research needs to be done about that question. But here's the thing. This kind of policy would be a game changer. Wyoming has the feel of being a pretty top-heavy police state when it wants to be. Wyoming tries to enjoy the image of being a place where people have the freedom to do whatever they want. That image is deployed to protect the privileged and to evade self-examination in the state. When push comes to shove, too many Wyoming leaders are prepared to defer to the cops. The support and interest that ACOP has received, the growing awareness of violent policing going on all over the state, gives us some hope that ordinary working people can change the attitudes of local leaders, or replace those leaders altogether, starting with the Republicans on the Albany County Commission. Albany County for Proper Policing is at acop.org, acopp.org. You can visit that site, you can make a donation to them, and learn more about what they're doing and how to get involved. For many of us, it could be a matter of life and death. This has been Solidarity Wyoming. I'm Matt from Solidarity House Cooperative.